Hey, what's up, everybody? On this week's Sport Light podcast, we sit down with former college quarterback Stephen Covey. You probably recognize that name, and he comes with the wisdom and perspective of his father and grandfather and shares a lot of experiences that he had with them and his own insights on being a great teammate, on time management, getting the most out of our athletic experiences. It was an amazing discussion. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Sportlight Podcast for parents, coaches, and athletes. The Sportlight refers to the time in an athlete's life when they have increased ability to affect the culture around them and the increased opportunity to learn life's lessons through sports. This podcast aims to help parents and coaches capitalize on their athletes' precious time in the Sportlight. The Sportlight Podcast is brought to you by Especially for Athletes program.
Thank you for joining us today. Our guest today is Stephen H. Covey, and you may have heard that name before with an R in the middle, Stephen R. Covey, or the Covey family. It's a very popular name, especially in the state that we all live in here in Utah. But we've got Stephen H. Covey, who is the grandson of Stephen R. Covey, a good friend of ours and friend of the program. And Stephen, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Dustin. Really excited to be here.
Stephen, you and I, our history isn't super long knowing each other. It goes back, I don't know, several years, 8-9 years or so. We were actually lived in the same neighborhood. At the time, I was coaching football and had seen your brother play. And I had told somebody that your brother was the most electric football player I had ever seen. There was just something extremely unique about the way he moved and his burst and speed, and your brother Britton Covey went on to play at the University of Utah and is now playing for the Philadelphia Eagles and having a great career so far. I think it's 2 years in the NFL, I believe. So there's a million things we want to talk to you about, what you do for a living, obviously the history of your dad and your grandpa father and the impacts they've had on millions of people with the things they've shared and then the things that you're doing. But I want to start by asking you, how do you feel not being as good as your brother, Britton?
it's a good question. And it's a deep question. So here's my Uncle Rico moment. So, I played football growing up. I played at Timpview High School. I was the quarterback. And we had a lot of success as a team. So we won state back in 2004. And I got a scholarship to play at BYU, which is great. So I was there with Coach Mendenhall's first year in 2005. And I had big dreams and big aspirations for my collegiate career and also had dreams and aspirations for the NFL, playing pro as well. And it really was important to me. And I really focused on working hard and doing everything in my power to make that. Unfortunately, there was injuries, things not within my control, and also things within my control that happened during my collegiate career, where I basically was a backup the entire time that I was at BYU. And, you know, I got in garbage minutes, essentially. So the collegiate career did not go as planned or as I had hoped. And then clearly there wasn't a chance of playing pro after that. So it's something that I really grappled with. And this is kind of the concept I wanted to talk about, is this concept of having intrinsic self-worth. And as an athlete, it's really difficult because, especially growing up as an athlete, you play sports and most people know you play sports. And if you're good, then they'll come up and talk to you and say, hey, how's football going? Or how's this sport going? It kind of becomes your core identity in a lot of ways, because that's just what everyone talks to you about. And it becomes so almost encompassing and engrossing. You don't realize it at the time. But what happens when it doesn't work out for an athlete is you have like a crisis of identity, because all of a sudden what you were known for and what people asked you about all the time just kind of goes away instantly. And so me personally, even growing up around my grandpa who talked about things like this all the time, I really had, my self-worth was totally dependent on outcomes and external validation, not on anything internally. And then to take it back to your question around Britain, and then to have my younger brother, who I love, rise up and be this phenomenal player, as you mentioned. If you go and watch his high school highlight, it's the most incredible thing ever. To have him do really well and then basically have all the success in football that I wanted, right, and that I had dreamt about, it was a difficult moment, when that all happened. You know, having he had success at Utah, and then he made it in the NFL, and I always believed he was going to make it. But there's many times where I don't know if I would call it jealousy, because I've always been so happy for Britain. Yeah. But there is that part of me that says, like, why couldn't that have been me, right? In a way, it's just natural questions, especially when someone within your own family.
Yeah.
And so I've really had to, and this is kind of the point for athletes, is I think it's really important to try and cultivate intrinsic self-worth and self-security. Do not be dependent on coaches, family members, friends, external people validating you based on external achievements and accomplishments. Now, it's easier said than done, but I wish I would have had more awareness around this. And having that intrinsic self-worth is so key. That's going back to something my grandfather used to say, is he used to say one definition of leadership is communicating to someone their worth and potential so clearly that they begin to see it in themselves. And I love that definition of leadership. And my big point through that whole story is it's possible to have intrinsic security, not be reliant on external factors. And that also when you have that intrinsic security inside, it allows you also to be happy for others. You can have an abundant spirit. And when someone else succeeds or has accomplishments, you don't feel threatened by that. You don't feel like they've taken something away from you. So it's just a key principle that when I came on this podcast, I just wanted to share, because I think, nearly every athlete, even those who make it to the pros, right? So even my brother Britton, when his career is over, whenever that is, you hear that a lot from pro athletes too, that they have a crisis all of a sudden because what they were known for all of a sudden goes away. So whether you actually quote unquote make it or not, it's still, it's still something you have to address.
Yeah.
Well, and that's something that, I mean, Dustin, you're probably thinking of the same conversation we've had with a great friend of ours, Max Hall. And Max Hall
Love has Max.
Been very open about his addiction struggles. And one of the things that he has shared to try to help young people not fall into some of the trap that he fell into and overcame is the very principle that you're talking about. He talks about how, I'm still that. Like, I love being a football player, but it can't be your most important identity. And I love some of the things that he shared in regard to that. But he attributes that very kind of crisis and trying to hold on to that athlete within him to leading to some of his struggles with addiction. And sometimes it's not always that dramatic addiction, but it can be things that are still harmful. Dustin, what are you thinking? I have a question for him, but I want to get your thoughts on that.
I think, Stephen, everybody, you're right. At whatever level, we call that the turning off of the spotlight. And that when that happens, it's pretty sudden. Sometimes that light gets so bright that I think it burns kids. It's too bright. They don't know how to handle it. But you get so used to it, and it's just human nature for your mind to start thinking, well, gosh, I'm pretty good. What could be next? And to keep you know, the drive to be better drives you to have these thoughts of, well, I could do this and that, and I could be great at these things. And then when it doesn't work out for whatever reason, at some point it doesn't work out for everybody. There's very few people that go out like Tom Brady went out. Sometimes it's like you said, it's an injury. It could happen in high school. You went from being the guy that was promising with everything going for you to you're just another student at the school. And the truth is, for the parents out there, statistics say there's about 5% of high school seniors when they graduate go on to play a sport in a college. That's all levels of college, Division III, II, junior college, 5%. So if I told you there was a 95% chance that your investment wasn't going to work, you would never invest in that company, right? You would never put your money into that stock if there was a 95% chance it wasn't going to work. But there is a 100% chance that you're going to be somebody's son or somebody's daughter and somebody's friend. And there's a high likelihood that you're probably going to be somebody's husband or wife and or a mother and a father. And so, you know, I guess, Shad, I know you have a question, but Stephen, let me just throw this at you and then Shad will fire. Maybe it's the same question, Shad.
Yeah, sure.
So we all believe in this. We all are on the same page on this, but how do we develop that, I guess, is the question I throw at Stephen and Shad. How do we tell a 14-year-old kid who's now accessing Instagram or social media, and now he has everybody telling him how great he is, and he's comparing himself or she is comparing herself to other people that are being successful and receiving praise for how well they dance or play a sport? How do we talk to these kids in a way to get them to understand their real worth isn't applauds and trophies and awards?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's hard when it's younger kids. First, I'll say too. I played with Max Hall at BYU. He was the starter, so I was in the same meeting rooms as him. And man, I'm so proud and amazed at Max Hall and what he's been able to do. You know, after everything went down, and him just kind of stepping up and having no ego about what happened to him, and in an attempt and in a way to help others. Like, it's incredible. I haven't talked to Max in years, but I just from afar seeing everything he's done is just absolutely incredible. As far as cultivating kind of this intrinsic self-worth, I think talking to the people that care about you most is an important thing, and asking them questions like, what is special about me? What do you see in me that's unique? And if you go and you have parents, or if you don't have parents necessarily, like some great friends or people that you know truly care about you, that is one way to hear that you as an individual. Like if one of my kids came and asked me, Dad, what's unique about me? I feel like I don't have any value or worth. Like I would instantly be like, oh my gosh, yes you do. And here's all the reasons why. And then on top of that, I would write down what people say about you and write those down in the form of affirmations. And I'm a big believer in affirmations. And this is me personally, how I've been able to develop this intrinsic security is writing down affirmations and reviewing those affirmations, sometimes daily, at least weekly, just as a reminder to myself of, okay, these are true statements about me, about my intrinsic value and self-worth that I have validated from, you know, my parents. And if people are religious, from, you know, from God, from scriptures, from principles that are true. And so that would be my recommendation, you know, for kids and for parents, if they're listening, to talk to their kids about this and say, hey, pull them aside and say, hey, I want you to know that ultimately I don't care the outcome of your football career or basketball career or anything. Yeah, I want you to succeed. I want you to be happy and reach your full potential with that. But ultimately, this is what I want you to know. I want you to know that you are a person with great intrinsic value and self-worth. You're someone that matters. You have a purpose in this life that's way beyond sports. And I don't know if a lot of parents, I know I've got a 13-year-old now, and I have to remind myself to talk to him about that, because I get in the sports mode, the dad mode of just being like, oh, let's get after this. We're going to, you know, you're going to pass for this many yards and, you know, do this. And I have to remind myself like, hey, what's the purpose of this? What's the purpose of football in general? It's to develop, you know, in the case of football, to develop young men. It's not about the ultimate outcome. So that would be, I know I kind of rambled there, but that would be my kind of recommendation.
Yeah, Dustin, in answer to your question, you'll remember that podcast we did on praising attributes instead of podiums, right? That I think it's really important to not focus so much on whether a kid wins or loses, to still find those things. Like my daughter plays tennis right now, and I should praise attributes after she loses just as much as I praise attributes after she wins, right? And I know it's always fun to be happy when someone wins, and it's great to be happy. But the things we praise, I think, are the things that they'll internalize the most. And even in a loss, just, I can't tell you how proud I am of you, that you just kept in there, that you were mentally strong, that you were fighting to the end, and that you shook the girl's hand and smiled and pleasantly said, nice game after. Like, you're such a great person who tries so hard at what you do. I think praising those things, and maybe even as we're watching games, look for attributes, things you admire about your child that are separate from outcomes. And then have that discussion in the car, whether they win or lose. Because if we only have the attribute conversation when they lose, or when they get cut, or when their career's over, they kind of see right through it. Like, okay, you're looking for the positive in all the negative. But even when they win, if we're saying things like, that was a fun win, that was awesome to see you guys win. You want to know what I'm more proud of, though? You know, and then talk about attributes. I think it starts to help them see those things that are way more important than wins, losses, future sports opportunities. Those attributes are true in school, in their friendships, in their relationship with their family and God, and all those things. And so I think if we praise those things, it will help those things to stick as who they are, even when sports fades away.
Well, we as parents, we really shouldn't be more proud of our child if they played well, right? Mm-hmm. But yet that seems to be what we do when there's a 4-for-4 game in a baseball game and your son got 4 hits. Man, I'm so proud of you. You know, you have 2 home runs today. So proud of you. But we shouldn't be less proud when they go 0-for-4 with 4 strikeouts. They tried in both scenarios. They just, sometimes the game doesn't allow for you to have success. It's praising the process and the emphasizing the lessons learned in the process, rather than what, Shad, what you said, the podium or the outcome, the reward or award or whatever's after. And that's hard to do. But the truth is that, like the percentages I threw out earlier, if there's a 95% chance you're not going to go play in a sport in college, there's a 100% chance you can learn some super valuable lessons from sports if we'll emphasize those lessons instead of emphasizing the outcome or the score or the award or, you know, right, and making that the focus. Then when kids finish playing, Stephen, to your earlier point, it's yeah, but. And that yeah, but is yeah, but I wasn't all state. Yeah, but I wasn't all region. Yeah, but I didn't get a scholarship, or I didn't go pro, or I didn't whatever. And all these other great things happened, but you have this yeah, but at the end, because the focus was on the outcome, not on all the things you developed, resiliency and hopefully time management and teamwork and accountability and responsibility and all these things you learned hopefully from the sport. But as parents and coaches, if we don't emphasize those things, and we just hope that the game will teach them that, we're going to miss it, because the game itself won't teach them that if we don't, you know, make sure that's being taught. It needs to be a priority. And Stephen, your grandpa has a quote that Shad and I use a lot when we speak. In fact, every time this year when we spoke to to schools or to groups, where he talks about your schedule and how important that is, that if we fill our day with stuff, we first need to have our priorities on there. Otherwise, our day will just fill with things and stuff and to-do items that will never get done. I wanted to kind of ask you that, Stephen. I met your grandpa one time. Ironically, it was right before our book was coming out, and I was talking to him about our book. And it was shortly, within a month after that, that he passed away. But obviously, his impact is international. Tell us a couple things, maybe being his grandson. Like, what's something that you really took from having a grandpa that was so good at sharing his words in written form and you know, verbalizing it and writing so many powerful messages for people?
Yeah, first, well said. And I'll tell you what I think of when I think of my grandpa is, ironically, I get asked, and people ask me all the time about this. I don't think of my grandpa in terms of his international fame, in his books, in the success that he had. I think of him in terms of how he made me feel when I was around him. And he truly was someone that kind of lived what he taught. And I remember being in high school and, you know, junior high and high school, and just not really realizing that my grandpa was like famous and well known. And to me, he was just my grandpa who loved me and cared about me deeply. He would, again, with his schedule, he would plan out a year in advance to be able to make it to grandkids' games, and would fly, you know, crazy hours just to be able to be home to kind of be there. And in fact, kind of a funny story. I remember one time my grandpa came to a game when I was in eighth grade, and he was able to come at halftime, and he said, "I'm so sorry that I wasn't there for the first half." He's like, and I was like, "Oh, it's okay. I just appreciate you being here." And he would always be affirming and saying, "You're just magnificent. You're wonderful." And then after the game, my dad was like, "You know, you really have to be grateful." We call them Papa. You have to be grateful to Papa. I mean, he literally was with the Dalai Lama before he came to your game. And I was like, "Who the heck is the Dalai Lama?" Right? It's like, eighth grade, I had no idea what it was. And as I've reflected on that story again, it's like, wow, how amazing is that? Where, you know, he was with a global icon, the Dalai Lama, and yet was in a hurry to get back to his, you know, 13-year-old grandson's football game. I mean, that's incredible. And that's where he, you know, in terms of time management and everything, where he would always talk about the, you know, the four quadrants and focusing on things on the second quadrant. So things that are important, but not urgent. And those are the hardest things for us to focus on, especially in today's world, especially with just the chaos and phones and notifications and just everything happening. Usually that second quadrant of kind of the time management matrix is the first thing that gets put to the side, because it's not urgent. It's not acting on us. So it takes a lot of discipline, and it takes a lot of being very intentional, just like you're saying, where you schedule your priorities. You schedule the things that really matter, and then you obviously have to live that commitment. But that's an example of how my grandpa did that, you know, in my own life. Just kind of one example.
That's a great story. The Dalai Lama.
Yeah, know? I know.
But it shows, it shows in his mind how he ranks people, you know, and the Dalai Lama is a very important person, but not as important as my own grandson. That says a lot about who your grandpa was and what he was like. I love how you said he actually lived what he taught other people. And so that's something that's so important.
Well, that's, Chad, would you not think that in the presentations we give and the things we talk about, when we talk about cell phone use, for example, you may have noticed that on the freeway that runs through our state, there's a sign right now that says, I can't remember the organization, some national organization on child behavior or something. Oh, it might, I think it might be this, the Surgeon General. It's like a warning, you know, like you'd see on the back of a cigarette carton that it could cause, you know, cancer. It says that cell phones and social media can be dangerous to kids' health, mental health. And I remember I've driven by this sign now several times, and I want to just, it's just like, really? Like, we're finally now, we got to put a sign up to tell people this. Like, we've been, it's so obvious, and we've been talking about this for so long, but great, there's a sign up there. But what are we doing to help these parents understand that, A, you got to be careful with your kids, but B, to this point that you just made, Chad, on Stephen's last comment, what example are we setting for our kids with our use of our own devices? If our children are growing up, which they are, in a world where they know nothing but devices, they've all, you know, our current high school generation were born when iPhones, iPads, Instagram, all this stuff was out. It was major part of the community. So that's all they've known. And then all of a sudden, and then we're telling them to not be on these things or to get off of them, but we're on them just as much. You know, I think parents, we've got to take more responsibility and not assuming that the school system or the coach or the church leader or the neighbor or whoever it is going to raise our kid to be socially responsible and be able to manage their time and to be able to, you know, all these things that we talk about. We have to be more intentional in having these discussions with our kids and make sure that they really are learning the lessons that they should learn from sports, because it's, if not, sports could be one of the worst things we do to our children. It sometimes destroys kids because they don't love it, and it's nothing but pressure and stress, and they feel like they're trying to make mom and dad proud of them, and that's only if they do well, and maybe they don't have a coach that's teaching these principles, and mom and dad are only talking about the performance and not about the lesson learned in the process, and then we spit them out into the real world, and they're not ready. So I kind of wanted to maybe ask both of you, we all have children, you know, mine and Chad's are a little bit older than yours, Stephen, but what did your dad do for you and Britton and your other siblings to help you guys, you know, understand the importance of A, the process, and B, what you said earlier, that you're more than just the sport that you play?
Yeah. My dad did a great job. Again, on the intrinsic self-worth side, it's something he would talk about, but I think even if you talk about it with people, it hits you at various stages in your life. So he was always great about that, but kind of around the process and not the outcomes, my dad was great. And it's not something I really, it's something in reflection that I've pondered on and realized that my dad was great about this, that concept where, again, like you were saying earlier, Chad, about praising not the outcome, but praising how you handled something within a game. He almost would give more praise. He would give more praise and attention to me and Britton and my other brother, Christian, and my sisters, when, you know, when we were kind to someone or when we were, went out of our way to help other people. That was like more praise than winning a state championship, right? Was the focus on things like, you know, that nature, like that was really important to them. But kind of, you know, reflecting on this whole, so that whole, the whole concept of focusing on the process and not the outcomes, it's something I've kind of been obsessed with for a while. I don't know if you ever saw Nick Saban. When Nick Saban gave his introductory press conference when he took over at Alabama, I think it's worth every coach, parent, you know, athlete to go and rewatch that. So this was before Alabama's dynasty, right? He gets up to the podium and he essentially says, I actually have some of it written down because I just love what he says, but he basically says, I think it's more important that you're able to take your expectations and bridge them into the process of what it takes to be successful. I want to use this as an example. When we won the national championship at LSU in 2003, the players developed the goals for the team. And I thought it was interesting that that this was the first team I had ever coached that didn't have the goal that was result-oriented, like go to a New Year's Day bowl game, win the SEC championships, or some goal that was result-oriented. This team, they had five goals, had nothing to do with winning a game, and didn't say anything about results. And he goes through and lists. And I've done research on this. I've had different accounts of what those five goals were, but basically these were the five goals that LSU had. Was the first one was to be a team. The second one was to work every day to dominate your opponent. The third one was to finish plays. The fourth one was execution, meaning you are responsible for what your role is and what you need to do. And then the fifth one, which was interesting, positively affect your teammates every day in the choices and the decisions that you make. And then one of the players on the team said, his name's Rodney Reed. He was one of the offensive tackles. And he basically said, if we live up to those five goals each day, then we're successful. If we do all those things and something outside of your control, like the BCS or the polls happens to keep you from winning a championship, you can still be a champion in everything you do. That's a goal you can set and achieve. You don't have to worry about somebody taking that away from you. And man, that's just mind blowing, right? Because you think Nick Saban, the winningest head coach ever, considered by majority of people the greatest coach of all time, in his introductory press conference, he doesn't talk about winning. He talks about the process. Hmm. He doesn't talk about outcomes. He talks about this is what we're going to be known for. And that, again, this is before he had the success. So you want to ask the question, how did they have that success at Alabama? Man, he stated it right at the beginning. He said, we're not going to be focusing on winning. Yeah, I want to win, obviously. We're focused on who we're becoming and this process. And then look at the run that he had. Like, amazing. So anyways, that's just one thought. I've been obsessed with that ever since I read that. And there's other athletes like Kobe and others who talk about that too. It's the process. It's the journey. It's not the destination. But yet in society, we're so focused on the outcomes, right? So focused on it. Yeah. But I think there's real power in having that mindset shift, whether at a team or as an individual, to not be focused on the outcomes.
That's really cool. And I've heard it said too, like every now and then people think that a vision is a goal, you know, that like vision is maybe the destination and it's okay to have a dream, you know, yeah. We want to be national champions, but that's not a goal. It's not actionable. It's not a tactical plan. And what I love about those five that you listed there is all of those are within control. There's only two things that affect every one of those five goals, and that is attitude and effort, right? And so if you have the right mindset, the right attitude, and you're willing to put in the effort, you could achieve all five of those. And there's so often we get lost in goals, or we worry and give so much energy to things that are outside of our control, and then we don't achieve them. We did everything within our control to achieve them, but someone just is better than us, right? Like I could set all the goals in the world. I'm never going to beat LeBron James in a one-on-one game. Like it's not going to happen. So sometimes we get so worried about that vision of what we want, that outcome, that we forget about those five things that really mean something. And can I ask you to read something one more time and then ask a follow-up question?
Yeah.
That Dustin, I'm sure you have some thoughts on this too. Will you read the fifth one again?
The fifth one was positively affect your teammates every day in the choices and the decisions that you make.
See, that's amazing to us because we talk about, we have our motto of eyes up, do the work, right? And when we talk to teams, we say, start with those on your own team, right? Like, there's kids on every high school team that are on the team but don't feel like they're part of the team. They don't feel valued. They don't feel like they have any worth. And so start there, and then you can start, you know, those circles of influence going out. But start with your own teammates and positively impact them. And going back, maybe connecting two thoughts that you've shared when you were talking about your brother Britton and watching your brother succeed. And within all of us, Dustin and I have had college baseball teammates that have gone on and made it to the major leagues. And you know, it's we went one time, flew out to watch one of our buddies play in Colorado. And it's hard not to watch him like on the field and go, man, that guy was really good, but he wasn't that much better than me. Yeah. Like, how did he make it there? I could have made it here. You know, like kind of like every athlete, every competitor has those thoughts, right? And with you, you watch your brother succeed and you're full of joy for him and everything. But there is that side of it that's like, dang it, man, what if little things would have gone differently for me? But that happens within a team as well. And sometimes it causes this contention or backbiting or trying to demean teammates or trying to make teammates look bad, either in the eyes of the coach or in the eyes of other teammates, just to try to raise ourselves on that ladder of importance within a team. So I just had a question about connecting that number five there of lifting your teammates, and then what you've learned as you've found joy in and tried to help your literal brother succeed. What advice would you give to those who are on teams about the way they should treat their teammates and being happy for their success instead of threatened by it?
Yeah, good question. And I actually, as you were talking, I was reminded, you know, you mentioned some of the players that may not be contributing as much on the field and things of that nature. And I literally have not thought about this for 20 years, but when I was a sophomore in high school, I played basketball my sophomore year. I played basketball sporadically, and I wasn't that good. And I played my sophomore year, and I got hardly any minutes. And as the season went on, I actually got worse. So I just like wasn't even seeing the court at all. And I started becoming like really annoyed, really bugged. And it was actually my dad who noticed this and came to me and said, "Steven, I'm noticing you're not being supportive of your teammates. I'm noticing that you're on the bench, not present in the game." And it kind of like took me back a little, because my dad is like the kindest person ever. And he wasn't mean or anything, but just was very direct and said, "Look, I know this season is not panning out like you want it to, but number one is we're not gonna quit," because I had talked to him about quitting. I was like, "I'm just gonna quit." And he's like, "We're not gonna quit. You're gonna finish this year strong. And I want you to have a different paradigm, a new mindset about this, where you are there to help your team and you are there to support everyone. So you're gonna make guys better in practice. You know, you're fast, you're quick, you can play defense like a madman. You know, you are going to give everything you have and be totally engaged in this." And that's to my dad's credit for doing that and pointing it out to me. But it did. It changed the rest of this. It was, you know, 8 more games left in the year or something like that. And I did. I took my dad's advice and I changed my mindset. And everything changed for me. Yeah, I wasn't contributing on the court. I'd get 1 or 2 minutes a game. But when I had that shift, it was like it was amazing, because I was like, "Man, I'm going to make my teammates better. I'm going to do everything in my power to, you know, have the coach be happy with me." And then I actually did start getting a bit of a uptick in minutes at the end, ironically, but that's kind of beside the point. The point is, if you're in that position, you still have control over certain things, you know, things that necessarily aren't on. There's other things within your power that you can control. So anyways, I'm glad I honestly have not thought about that for 20 years. So yeah, this came out.
Can you imagine if every parent took that approach to parenting that your dad just took? You know, I coach, as you guys know, and I coach in a community that for the most part gets it and they've been great. But in 20 years of coaching and at several different schools over the years, including the one that I'm currently at, there are plenty of parents out there that they're all about their son being a great teammate as long as he's playing and as long as he's doing well. And then it's hard because this whole idea of team is so hard to build. It's so easy to say, but to really build it and to have a culture of teamwork, because that requires sacrifice for the sake of the team. It requires you doing your job when your job might be to cheer really loud, or your job might be to be on a scout team and get pummeled by this first team guys and never play a game, or hope that you get in at the end of a game in a blowout or something. But your job is to be supportive of somebody that beat you out at a position. Your job might be to go put your arm around somebody who's had a bad game and make them know that they're more than just how they performed on the field. But we oftentimes, as parents, Shad and I have talked about the ride home. I've used the word sacred. I think that the ride home with a son or daughter after a game is sacred time. Whether they win or lose, play, didn't play, whatever, what we say in that 10-minute ride home is so important. And our response to how they played, good or bad, is so important. When we point out, you'll take your situation, Stephen. If your dad or another dad or mom of another player on the team or the coach came to you when you were being supportive of your teammates and pointed that out to you, that, hey, Steven, I know you're not playing as much as you probably wish you would, but man, I love watching the way you interact with your team, the way you treat your teammates. I can tell how much they value you being on the team because of that. That's what leadership is. That's what leadership is in a role where, you don't have to be the very best player to be the leader. Sometimes the best leaders are the guys who don't play. But they're the glue. You have to have them on your team, right? Or the team is full of a bunch of good players, but they never stick. And you see teams like that are full of great players who don't end up maximizing their potential because they're doing their own thing and their own selfish agendas. They never came together as a team. And this understanding of, in order to create a team, you're an integral part of that. You're a piece in the puzzle. And your piece is finding what your piece is and what your role is hard, because you may have to accept the fact, like you had to, that my piece in this is a couple minutes a game. And so I have two options. I can tuck my tail between my legs and quit and blame the coach and blame the referees and blame whoever to deflect the accountability, or be a man and take it and say, well, I guess I'm not good enough, so I'm going to get better. But in the meantime, I've got to be a really good backup. But I'm not giving up. I'm not quitting. And I'm not blaming it on my coach. He doesn't want to lose. She doesn't want to lose. She's just playing somebody because she thinks they're better than me. My job is to change her mind. And I start by how I act on the bench so that they'll at least see that I'm engaged and involved. Because pouting, I can tell you one thing from a coach's perspective, parents, if your son or daughter chooses the pouting method, the path of pouting and feeling sorry for themselves or making excuses, they're going to have a hard time ever getting themselves back on the field or back on the court. Because as a coach, you don't stand for that stuff. So I think that starts at home too, and how we have for your dad to have that conversation with you and to do it in a way where you didn't feel offended by it, but just to be honest with you, and you knew he was proud of you, but he also knew that as a dad, his job was to train you for moments much bigger than an eighth grade or, whatever basketball game. And that was to understand that someday, Stephen, you may not be the CEO of the company. You may have another job within that organization. What you can't do is feel bitter and oppressed because you didn't get the CEO position and sabotage the company from your job is to be the best in the role that you've been asked to play and do. And the rest is up to, up to, in some cases, other people, but you got to take care of your job. And then when we say eyes up, do the work, eyes up is being aware. It's being aware that, okay, looks like I'm the backup. Now do the work to be the best backup you can be, but that doesn't mean don't try to beat the person out in front of you. It just means that you're, you know, you do the work. And today I'm going to be having to cheer really loud. Hopefully next week I'm playing, but today my job is to cheer really loud. And it's what we can't do as parents is get in the car and say, hey, your coach is an idiot. That's why you're not playing.
Yeah.
We create kids that think the same thing when they leave, and it's the government's fault, right? It's everybody else's fault but theirs for why they're not successful. And if we don't jump on that as soon as we see it as parents or as coaches, if we don't jump on that and teach the kid that that's not the right way to handle it, then we shouldn't be surprised if afterwards in other areas of their life, they handle it the wrong way. Because when they had a chance to learn it, we didn't teach it or emphasize the lesson that they're being taught and how this is going to help them later in life, which I'm guessing, Stephen, in your life, that experience you had right there that year, that basketball team, probably is the reason you were able to be ultimately so successful in football and go to a Division I college and be as successful as you are now as a father and husband and businessman.
Yeah, without a doubt. And reflecting on it, I remember then my senior year when I was, you know, the starting quarterback on the team, being able to relate really well to some of the kids that were not getting playing time and that were frustrated, and actually being able to go and say, hey, I get it. Like this happened to me. Like I understand, but I need you. Like we need you as a team. We have to all be bought in on this. You play an important role on the scout team. I remember talking with a sophomore when I was a senior who ended up becoming the starting running back later and was amazing, but you could see him kind of being mad that he wasn't getting time. And I remember having a conversation with him about that, and he just stepped up and just was incredible. Gave us an amazing look on scout team. So tying that all back to my grandfather's wisdom is, you know, the first foundational habit, habit one, be proactive. Where my grandpa used to talk about, you know, between stimulus or what happens to us and response, there is a space. And in that space, we have the freedom to choose our response. And in those choices lie our growth and our happiness. Mm. And that's a concept that's kind of foreign in today's world, right? It's just this constant victim mentality. Other people are doing it to you. The problem is out there. Rather than having the, okay, this happened to me, but I actually can choose my response to whatever stimulus happens to me. So yeah, I'm benched. That's the stimulus. How can I respond to that? Or as a parent too, right? The coach benched my son. So upsetting. He doesn't know what he's doing. But you got to think, this isn't just about playing time. This is about developing your child for life. But I get it. I'm a parent. Like, yeah, it's hard. It's easy to, right? It's easy to talk about the ideal when you're faced with reality and you feel wronged and this coach just doesn't see the potential I see. I get it. But that's where you have to remind yourself, are you raising just an athlete or are you raising a whole person?
You know, that's really awesome, Stephen. And I did have a thought as you were sharing that the Urban Meyer, when Urban Meyer was at Ohio State, he said E plus R equals O. They had that up in their weight room. Event plus response equals outcome. And that sometimes we spend so much time on that E in the equation or on the O when the one variable, like your grandfather taught, like that between stimulus like and response, there's this space, there's this decision, right? And we can affect the response, which is a huge part of that equation. I wrote something about this one time about victim mentality, that it seems like people are content with a crappy life as long as they have a good excuse for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they're just like, my life stinks, but hey, I got this great excuse. And I don't know how those two things have been added together in our society, that hey, as long as it's fine to have crappy life, as long as you have a good excuse, and that people become content with that, instead of saying, okay, here's what's happening, I have no control over that, but my response, I have a lot of control over my response, and I'm going to put all of my effort and ingenuity and imagination toward that, you know, toward the response, instead of toward making up excuses about why I'm a victim and why nothing can happen. And sports gives us little opportunities like that one you had. The event is, I'm not playing very much. I'm not seeing the court and I'm frustrated. That's great. But your dad helped you put all of your energy, ingenuity, and effort toward your response to that. And then it led to a way better outcome. But so I think that's so important for people to realize there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is so easy, again, in today's world, to just blame everything on other people, blame it on the government, blame it on, you know, a neighbor, a church leader, someone at your work. And it takes someone to, you know, it's responsibility. And that's something else my grandpa would always talk about, is you break down the word responsibility, response ability, or the ability to choose your response. Mm-hmm. And that always stuck with me. Like, that's what responsibility is. And man, sports is like the ultimate ground, especially, you know, for kids. Like, you can't have a better place for kids to be able to learn something like that. Cause how many times within a game do you have that, right? Stimulus response, losing games and having to, you know, cultivate, resilience. Like, that's why I love sports. They're just so, so good for development in ways that, you know, you can't replicate. You can do it in other arenas, but like, man, sports is just like this intense, like, trial by fire type of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, for us, I honestly think the most important thing that sports gives is the opportunity to learn those lessons. And as Dustin already referenced, 5% even go on to play junior college level ball, right? But sometime along the way, that spotlight's going to turn off. However, the lessons, if we're intentional as parents and coaches and as athletes to learn those lessons and to use sports to enhance attributes, that's going to help us as we move forward in life. And we could be more intentional about that, no matter what realm we're in as athlete, parent, or coach. And so I just have to say one thing and then ask you one more question before we hop off.
Yeah.
I saw you play. I just don't want anyone who has listened to this podcast not understand how good you were, because I still remember Mountain View, your senior year, first playoff game of the year, you and Harvey Unger, right? You played with Harvey? Yeah.
Yep.
And I remember watching you run around that field, and I turned to someone I was watching that game with, and I was at that game, and I turned to them and I said, you know what it was like to have Bo Jackson in Tecmo Bowl? That dude's like Bo Jackson in Tecmo Bowl. You were just running around everyone. And then as soon as they started chasing you, you would hand it off to Harvey Unger, and he would just prance up the middle of the field. So that was a pretty dynamic team. And you were one of the more dynamic athletes. I remember that 20 plus years later now. I remember that game at Mountain View. So I just needed to give you your props. A little bit here, because you were incredible.
It helped when you had Harvey as your running back right next to you, because he took a lot of attention. So for sure. But no, I appreciate that. I always joke with my kids, like, guys, let me have my Uncle Rico moment. So yeah.
Well, there, I gave them. Let them listen to that part of the podcast.
Yes,
like, some 47-year-old guy who just met you today remembers watching you run all over Mountain View's field and no one could catch you. So, but I wanted to go back to one thing. We talked about the four quadrants, right? And I have those right here on my phone.
Yeah.
I pulled them up, but some people may not have been familiar. The four quadrants are created by the relationship between important things and unimportant things, and then how urgent they are versus not being as urgent. And your grandfather taught that the more time we spend in that quadrant two, which is important but not urgent, the more productive we would be. And one of the things that we mentioned a little bit, but maybe I just with cell phones, we talked about cell phones. One of the dangers of cell phones is that cell phones make things feel urgent because of notifications that are very unimportant, right? For example, I get to sit in the back of a lot of classrooms in my profession, and I'm watching kids. And the amount of times they'll pick up their phone and look at it, like about something that's probably so mundane, but hey, they got a Instagram or a Snapchat notification or a text message notification, and it feels so urgent because our phone dinged or buzzed or whatever. And I've just been thinking about this quadrant a lot recently, that I think more than ever, we're spending our time in things that feel urgent, even though they may not be, but are very unimportant. And I would just love for you to speak to parents and maybe some, though we've already addressed it a little bit, specifically in regard to cell phone usage and how it can make us live in that quad three box instead of quad two. Do you just have any more advice or things you would give us to help us get to that quadrant two of things that are of great importance, but if we're living life right, we don't wait until they're urgent, if that makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just say that I'm as guilty as anyone when it comes to the cell phone. I mean, cell phones are literally these, I read it somewhere recently, this is like a $3 trillion device that are in our hands, developed by the smartest people in the world to basically keep your attention on that phone. Like it's a military grade $3 trillion device. We don't think of it in terms of that, but that's the reality. You think of the R&D money spent by app companies, by, you know, tech companies that actually manufacture the phones. I mean, it's insane. Like, it is so difficult, and I am not perfect at this at all. In fact, I struggle with it constantly. And like you're saying, most people, I think, spend very little time in quadrant two. So things that are important but not urgent. Majority of their lives are spent in quadrants one, three, and four. So, you know, quadrant four would be things that are not urgent, not important. So I liken that to being like playing games on your phone or something like that. Mm-hmm. Quadrant three is things that are urgent, but not important. So interruptions, notifications, things of that nature. And then there's the quadrant one, which are things that are both urgent and important. That's something you have to address. Mm-hmm. But one of the points my grandpa makes is the more time you can spend in quadrant two, so things that are important but not urgent, then the less you spend in quadrant one of things that are urgent and important that you have to address, because you're addressing big picture things up front. So I'll say something I'm experimenting with this myself, because the phone thing is, it's constant, it's for everyone. So if you're like probably most people like myself, I've played around with a lot of different apps on limiting screen time, mm-hmm. but I always find that I just unblock it anyways, right? Like, I was like, okay, I'm really motivated. I'm going to stop using my phone as much. I'm going to be more present, because I believe being present in the moment is the key with kids, and the phones is just such a huge distraction. So something I have it on my desk right here, but I just purchased this small device. It's called a Brick. This is it right here. Uh-huh. And basically it's a cool app you set up where you have to physically scan your phone, and then it will block whatever apps you don't want, and you can't use them again until you rescan it. So the idea being that you scan it like before you go out with your kids, so that you literally can't do it. I mean, it's sad that we have to resort to things like that, but you know what? It's that's why I say I don't have all the answers with it, other than I think you just have to keep trying until you find something that works for you. Yeah. Because you just the importance of, and you've talked about it, one of your core values, that, you know, win the hour, which is, man, the key, I think, to today's world, like to really stand out, to really be successful, to really have influence with people, is to be totally present with whatever you're doing. Because 95% of people are not present. You go to dinners, people are on their phones. You go to meetings, people are on devices. Like, it's, no one is truly like in the moment present. Like, very few people are. And if you can be, if you can figure it out, man, you have such an advantage just in life and in today's world, because we have everything working against us. Yeah. But again, we can ultimately choose to respond differently to it. Not saying it's easy, because again, I mean, you got me. I'm experimenting right now with how I can be better about this. So,
yeah, that's really great, though. So the brick.
Yeah, the brick. I'll send you the link to it. Yeah, I've just started experimenting with it, and it's really intriguing. So
we'll put it in our show notes, because it's,
yeah,
there are times where, like, that's why I brought this up, is I feel like we're living so much in quadrant three. And I love what you said, like, because of these military graded devices in our hands that are designed to get us to live in quadrant three, right? Mm-hmm. The unimportant stuff, it's designed to make that unimportant stuff feel urgent to us, even though it probably isn't urgent, right? And I just love on this, I've read the Seven Habits many, many times, right? And I love quadrant two, that the activities within that are prevention, capability improvement, relationship building, recognizing new opportunities, planning, recreation, purposeful recreation. And then the results are more vision and perspective, balance, discipline, control, fewer crises, right? And then you go over to that quadrant one, and if we're living in urgent and important because we haven't spent enough time in quadrant two, then the results of that, there's more crises, they're pressing problems, deadline driven, just we're only doing things at the last minute when they need to be done. And the results are stress, burnout, crisis management, and always feeling like we're putting out fires. And so when you start to compare, like, if we could spend more time on that, those things that are really, really important but are never going to be urgent, it's just going to be balance, control, fewer crises, versus quadrant three, where we're spending so much time because of phones, really. And he wrote this before phones, right? Like, yeah. It's almost prophetic, right? But interruptions, these are the activities. Interruptions, calls, notifications, some meetings, pressing matters, popular activities. But the results of living so much in quadrant three, short-term focus, crisis management, reputation, we're a chameleon character. We see goals and plans as worthless. We feel victimized, out of control, shallow, and broken relationships. And boy, doesn't that describe really well what we're seeing in our day because of the results of these things, you know? Yeah.
No, it's absolutely true. And I would say that just one more thought is probably the key activity that I have found in my life. And again, I'm not here to preach to anyone, because I struggle with this as much as anyone. But the weeks that I have good weeks with this is when I have what I call just a weekly review. And a lot of productivity experts and other people talk about this. I get this specifically from David Allen, who wrote a book called Getting Things Done. And I know David Allen personally. He's him and his wife Catherine, and they're great people. But that is probably the key for me to spend time in quadrant two is to have a weekly review, whether it's the beginning of the week, the end of the week, on Sunday night. You got to experiment with what works for you. But that's where you sit down and you outline for the week. Okay, here's my quadrant two activities. Here are the things that are super important, but they are not urgent. And then I literally have to schedule in my calendar when I'm going to do these activities.
Yeah.
And that's, for me, I found that's kind of the only way to do it. Otherwise, you're at the whims of every morning, right? Of all the emails, notifications, everything coming in. If you don't set aside that time to plan it, and it doesn't have to be anything crazy, it could be 20, 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. Then you look at the end of your week and say, hey, I did everything that was not urgent, or that was not urgent, but important. And then it's amazing what happens if you do that multiple weeks, then it starts to build, and then all the kind of the fruits of that manifest, then you actually feel it. And then it becomes kind of this upward spiral of growth. So that was that. I'd say, from a practical standpoint, outside of playing with things like this brick thing, is that's been most helpful for me.
Super awesome. Well, Stephen, man, all this stuff we're talking about is so close to our heart that we can talk about this stuff all day long. Right now, I was telling you, I'm studying your father's book, The Speed of Trust, and I mean, all these things we're mentioning are just, you, your family has just made such a great contribution. And we appreciate you taking your time today to be with us on the Sportlight Podcast. Thank you so much for everything that you've shared and the insights and experiences. You're awesome. We hope to have you on again.
Absolutely. Thanks, Chad. Appreciate it. Love what you're doing. I love Dustin. I think it's amazing just the approach that you take, and more parents need to hear it, for sure, myself included. So
me too.
Thanks, Chad. Appreciate it.
Me too. Well, thank you everyone for joining the Sportlight Podcast. Please like it and share it. And as always, eyes up and do the work.
This has been the Sportlight Podcast from Especially for Athletes, sponsored by Coca-Cola. You can learn more about Especially for Athletes by visiting the website at especiallyforathletes.org. You can also learn more about the book, The Sportlight, by Chad Martin and Dustin Smith at especiallyforathletes.org/book.